Do you manage your own IT for distributed teams in Asia? And you know how painful it is. Essavel helps your in-house team by taking cumbersome tasks off their hands and giving them the tools to manage IT effectively. Get help across 8 countries in Asia Pacific, from on and offboarding, procuring devices, to real-time IT support and device management. With our state-of-the-art platform, gain full control of all your IT infrastructure in one place. Our team of IT support pros are keen to help you grow. So check out esevel.com and get a demo today. Use our referral code ASIA for 3 months free. Terms and conditions apply.
I think the biggest learning that I had, and by extension, JLL, in my last capacity, was that it's not sufficient to take these companies and then just let them in the door. You can't hand one of your business lines the keys and expect them to drive. So one of the first cohort companies in Urban Lab was a robotics company, and we created a revenue sharing agreement with them. Any property that you get into through us, there's a revenue share. But the downstream incentives weren't sufficient enough. We didn't provide enough tools to the people who were actually interacting with the properties to then want to actually be able to do it. Most of them didn't even know about it. And that speaks to the size of an organization like that. But when you sit up in an organization, you sometimes forget you can't just speak something into existence, that you need a ground game.
Welcome to Analyze Asia, the premier podcast dedicated to dissecting the pulse of business, technology, and media in Asia. I'm Bernard Leung, and PropTech used to be the talk of the town for the real estate industry. Where is PropTech heading in the world of high interest rates? With me today, Jordan Kostelek, CEO of Deploy, a serial entrepreneur and former director of technology for PropTech in JLL Asia Pacific. Jordan, welcome to the show.
Bernard, thanks for having me. I love the conversation, Jeff, so I'm glad to be a part of one.
Yeah, it was great to have that coffee chat that last time when you came by Singapore. So this is probably a much more interesting conversation to start off with, is to find out your origin story. How do you start your career?
Well, I'm originally from Columbus, Ohio in the US. Unlike you, I wasn't a great student growing up. And so even by standards of an 18-year-old, I was very immature. So when I finished high school, I started a job in a warehouse while I was muddling about trying to figure out what I wanted to be when I grew up. Spoiler alert, I don't think I figured that out until about a year ago. And I'm not convinced that I've fully grown up just yet, but you know, we're all trying in our own ways. But yeah, look, I started in a warehouse, but I think where we are a bit similar is that we're kind of agents of change, if you will, you know, never sort of content staying in one place. You know, the nice way to put it is probably creatively maladjusted, though I think over the course of my career, a lot of people just say I'm a pain in the ass. But when I was working in the warehouse, I was constantly suggesting changes. Oh, we should do it like this. We should do it like this. And then eventually just started making the tools myself. Started with simple keyboard macros, right? We were using these old sort of DOS-based systems, and you could do the function keys and make a keyboard macro, but that would allow me to get through 4 screens in rapid succession. That eventually evolved into me developing what we'd now call full-scale apps. And at the time, this was MS Access. So no one would call it an app by today's standards. But, you know, I was creating these effective set of tools, oftentimes without permission, but that allowed me to be better at my job. And then when other people started adopting them, they got better at their jobs, and the rising tide lifted all ships. And so doing that process of discovery, it helped resolve that question of what I wanted to be when I grew up. So for a while, or so I thought. So for a while, having been thrust into a sort of supporting role for business process reengineering, I thought I wanted to be a management consultant. And I came to that realization in the very auspicious year of 2007 in the US. So right before the GFC hit. And so I was on track to finish my undergraduate and start a consulting career, but then the GFC hit. And basically, the bar went even higher. You had to have a master's degree to really get into the management consulting world. So then I decided to pursue an MBA, but not content with doing it from a cubicle in Columbus, Ohio, I moved to a city in China that no one had ever heard of at the time, but now everyone knows, Wuhan. did a year in Wuhan before moving to Hong Kong and starting the phase of my career, the beginning of this chapter of my career that we're in now, and I think we'll talk in more detail.
And then how do you eventually end up in your present role as a founder of a couple of businesses? But before we get to that, but maybe we want to talk about some of the things that you do where you also was working with JLL PropTech as well.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, because my warehouse background was in essentially supply chain management, but really it was process, right? And process, there's a sort of unfortunate reality of the past two decades that office work and factory work were really not far off from how they were perceived as, how they were measured and managed, right? To quote Peter Drucker. And they, you know, when I was looking for a job after I had finished my MBA, I was fortunate enough to be hired by a boutique consulting firm that did change management, largely focused around large scale corporate relocation. So a big bank wants to move from this building to that building. It's the same logistical planning as getting a box from one end of a warehouse to another to somebody's front door. And so that's where it all started. But that's when I started to move more towards change management. Change management evolved into change management and workplace strategy, which is what I was hired then to do at JLL. Again, whether you call it pain in the ass or creatively maladjusted, in that time as a change manager and a workplace strategist at JLL, I was constantly saying, oh, you know, tech is coming for us, you know, it's eating our lunch, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I started sending out these sort of unsolicited newsletters to leadership. Here's tech, here's this, kept raising issues. And eventually that led to them asking me to take that same change management and transformative methodology and turn that lens inward to JLL. And that was what the last 5 years leading up to the year of founding Deploy, that was really what led to that job. And that job in its functional nature was basically sort of threefold. It was ecosystem engagement, which is what will have led to Deploy. So we'll come back to that. But it was also evangelizing, speaking the gospel of prop tech at conferences, you know, with our clients, things like that. And then on the internal side, on the transformation lens, it was really advising executive leadership on the feasibility of technology and its integration into the organization, because that's like, corporates are just as bad at integrating as startups are at infiltrating, right? And so that was being able to balance that, or hopefully get to that, was a big part of my responsibility. And then to wrap that, you know, it's only long because, you know, I'm now getting into the 25th year of my professional career. But to wrap that all up, a lot of the ecosystem engagement, the fundamental thing that surfaced as I was engaging the prop tech startup community across Asia. So this means from New Zealand all the way to India, everything in between. I saw too many startups whose pitch began with, we're this and we've raised this much. And we got through most of the pitch before we had any clue what they could do, let alone how they would integrate into an organization of 100,000 people. So there were a lot of overfunded startups that were solving non-existent problems. We'll definitely get into that as we talk about, you know, the deeper issues with PropTech.
Sure.
But there were a lot of great startups who couldn't find funding. And so that's what led to Deploy. And I know we'll talk about Deploy in more detail later, so we can come back to that.
So before we get to the main subject of the day, I just want to ask, you have a pretty interesting career journey, started just from warehouses and get all the way to Hong Kong, working in real estate and maybe even into now venture capital. Can you tell me what are the lessons you can share about your career journey with my audience?
Look, the biggest lesson I learned was actually in the earliest days in the warehouse. It didn't always stick with me, but when I was 22, but honestly, I don't remember. I was too young to be promoted into a management role. That's what I know for sure, because I was asked, part of that responsibility was to coach people two and three times my age. And one time I was coaching a particular staff member on their output. So we had two main measures of the floor staff in the warehouse. It was accuracy and productivity. Productivity was measured in the units that you would process in a given hour. I had to coach her. My responsibility was to coach her because she was hitting something like 80% productivity. And I thought at the time that meant I needed to be the boss and tell her to go faster, right? But I handled it so poorly, I ended up on coaching myself. So my boss, you know, brought me in when I kind of protested, I'm just doing my job. My much better manager told me I wasn't looking at the whole picture. And the boss gave me time to just go marinate with it and figure it out. And after, I think, staring at it for what felt like an hour, but knowing my attention span was probably closer to 4 minutes, I noticed that the employee had 99.9% accuracy, which was off the charts. No one gets that close. And when I went back and said, oh, here's this, that's what the boss was like, yeah, you figured it out. The big lesson here was that, you know, they put lots of care into their work. She cared deeply about a task that me as a young, ambitious person couldn't even wrap my head around, that a person could care about this work, right? To me, it was just trivial. And, you know, given the chance to reflect on it in that time, and then over the course of 20 years, I realized that there's always a human factor. And work that might be undesirable or referred to incorrectly, I might add, as low skill. When an organization gives those people the right tools to do their job with pride and to do it as effectively as possible, that's when organizations perform the best. And I think we'll get into that more deeply about how that's informed what I really try to drive when in my last role at JLL, and what I think the prop tech industry and probably the wider just innovation economy really needs. Mm.
So that comes to the main subject of the day. I want to talk about prop tech in this present day, and also based on your experience, and also talk about deploy as such. I think the best way to start is to go back and look at the industry as itself. Can you give me an overview of the real estate industry and the total market opportunity of just the prop tech sector within that industry itself?
Real estate is really hard to pin down, right? It's, you know, by some estimates, it's a $10 trillion industry. Urban Land Institute, which I'm, you know, full disclosure, a member of, they put the Asia real estate market at $2.5 trillion, something like that. But like, how do you carve up Asia? Is Australia and New Zealand in there? You know, where do the borders end? That kind of thing. It's hard to pin down. And then that also leads to misalignment, or we'll say more often than not, overstatement of what's there. I think in principle, what we can recognize about real estate is why we call it real. We call it real because it is a fundamental human need, like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? We're talking about shelter. You know, you're in Singapore, I'm in Hong Kong. A big part of that is comfort, right? Like, it's getting oppressively hot in Hong Kong at the moment. It's also been raining for 4 days straight. It's a lot of things you can't get done in those conditions. And look, real estate, by and large, you know, the older the sector, the harder it is to innovate. Real estate is often reduced to being slow to adopt, but I don't fully agree with that. I'm sure we'll touch on that more. But like, talking about the opportunity in the technology sector, I like to say that, you know, computers started the size of rooms, right? The old punch card machines were the size of rooms, and now they've gotten down to this, right? Or even more so this. So for those just listening, I just showed my phone and showed my watch. But computing power has gotten real dense, but what it hasn't done is then been redistributed within the building. So much of what are very complex machines have not been fully digitalized and then able to really use the data to do things like capture efficiency, create better experiences, and things like that. So in terms of the opportunity, if real estate's a $10 trillion market that will continue to grow, then I would say that the prop tech market is easily an $8 trillion market. There's that much room to go. The question becomes this definition of what is prop tech, right? This has been a sort of ground level fight between those of us who have been in the discussion for a long time. Is the word prop tech even a useful language device anymore? In 2024, what commerce isn't married to tech at this point?
Let me work backwards from your former role as a director of technology at prop tech in JLL Asia Pac. Can you talk about like what is the kind of coverage that you do in that role, and how do you influence, say, technological innovation within the company, and use that maybe as a base definition of what prop tech means to you?
Can I start at the end? So what does prop tech mean to me? Yeah. Look, property technology is anything that really enhances any aspect of the real estate life cycle. But what I think the job of technology is actually much simpler than most people put. The job of technology is to eliminate tedium, because tedium is where slowdowns happen. So when I gave that story earlier about the employee who took pride in their work, my job, had I known what I do now at the time, was to eliminate the tedious aspects of her work. We actually shifted that lady into an audit role where she inspected other people's packages. We sort of capitalized on her ability to be really accurate and be deliberate. And so the job of technology is to eliminate, I think, tedium is probably secondary to safety, but we do already hold safety paramount. I think most organizations do, and that, you know, certainly JLL did when I was there, and I know that they still do. So safety is the first one. That's the job of technology. But then secondary to that, eliminate tedium, because with the elimination of tedium creates momentum. When we have, like, we all know that. We all, you know, in hustle culture, the talk now is about flow state. Well, the job of tech is to amplify flow state, right? So, you know, when I know when you started your career and when I started mine, we were hearing so much about how email is going to eliminate, it's going to eliminate paper. Well, you live in Singapore, I live in Hong Kong. We know that paper is keeping itself very much alive, but that was the job. That is the mission, is eliminate that tedium. So anything that does that in the real estate life cycle, and where that opportunity sits the most, is all the unseen things that happen in buildings. So the example I love to use is, no one notices when a toilet is sparkling when they walk into it. So you go into a shopping mall or anything else like that, but everyone notices when it's disgusting, right? And so that, you know, it's a big graphic, so I apologize to listeners, but like the whole point is like there's a visceral connection there, but there's a thankless part of it that goes on in the background. So the more we can make those thankless tasks through technology efficient and effective, the better off the entire environment, which it is an extension of the environment, is going to be. And actually, that word environment is a really important one these days. You're seeing a big trend away from this portmanteau of prop tech and more to built environment technology, or technology for the built environment, is really where the language of it's going.
And I think I probably should just tell everyone that built environment is also a rather nuanced jargon for construction sites.
Yes.
As such. Right? A lot of people, we call it the built environment, actually is construction tech, and we're seeing a lot of that. But maybe, because I think JLL is in the management of the real estate, they touch us a little bit more on the higher level of the real estate industry within the supply chain itself. Can you talk about some of the projects you led at JLL, and how does it maybe transform or help the company's operations across the different business lines? I think, like you said, right, technology doesn't need to be necessary. It must always be a cool piece of tech, like maybe an AI or an IoT device. But also maybe it's just something very, very basic. It could be just something you digitalize. It could be as simple as a form that actually improves a few people's work processes as such.
Yeah, look, so I think the projects where a lot of my focus was, and so this all began in 2018. We have to sort of play back or remind your listeners that the sort of state of real estate and the state of venture and innovation economy at the time, 2018 was before WeWork's S1 came out. So a lot of focus was on, you know, how do we optimize spatial efficiency, and how do we design better and more CapEx light? How does real estate become a less capital intensive sector by extension? And so, you know, JLL at its core is still a transactions firm. All of the big property giants are. So I can speak to my experience at JLL, but whether it's CBRE, Cushman & Wakefield, Savills, Colliers, you can name any of the top firms, and they're all at their core transactions. Transactions will be the biggest part of their profit margins. But the annuity businesses, the things that really sort of keep the revenue stream going, are the property management, the facilities management. Those definitions, you know, are two separate things as well. So property management tends to refer to who's taking care of the whole asset, the shared aspects of it. And facilities tends to refer to the narrower occupied space, servicing a specific client within the space. They touch all those aspects of the life cycle, but a lot of focus is on transactions. So how are we capturing data, right? What data is being captured, and how can successful models be replicated around the region? So a lot of my early focus was on transactional data, stock data, things like that. The One of the big news as we're recording this is that CoStar in the US has just acquired Matterport. CoStar is often perceived as a technology company, but is more of a data aggregator than anything. And a lot of their processes are super manual. But the holy grail of Asia in particular is, and I've heard this pitch 1,000 times, is people wanting to build the CoStar of Asia or the Bloomberg of real estate for Asia, the same thing. And I know this is veering a bit away from the question, but it's a good point at which to sort of say this is, like I said, I've heard that pitch 1,000 times, but something that works in Singapore does not translate even as far as JB, right? Like it, just across the border into Malaysia, the data is not, you know, organized or even oftentimes in ones and zeros. And so you try to transfer that around the region, complexities of all the languages and currencies and stuff, it just doesn't work the same as it does in North America. But that doesn't stop a lot of people from trying. And someday someone will crack it, but I don't believe that that can be anytime soon. But the other project I would want to mention is we spent a lot of time working on a project called Check It, which was an augmented reality inspection and maintenance tool. And there's some lessons that we can talk about from that around what mistakes corporates make when trying to integrate tech and mistakes that startups make when trying to infiltrate, as I said before. But we were building this AR inspection maintenance tool because, as I said before, if you make the most tedious work better and more efficient, all that data that we would have captured also floats up. So in today's world, 99.9999% of all inspection records are done on a sheet of paper. They go into a box file and that's it. Everyone should want that data because all of that data is incredibly powerful, especially when aggregated. So we thought, let's capture that at the edge. Now, there's a lot of apps that do that. You can fill out a form right there on the mobile app, but filling out a form is still tedious and it still sort of invites people to shorthand or to skip steps. So we made it a more interactive thing. Using the mobile device, you could walk straight up. You could basically be guided like Pokemon Go. You could be navigated directly to what you needed to inspect or correct. And you could go through and check everything and capture the data right there. What was interesting about it, and again, this was 3-4 years ago at this point, long before the AI boom was really starting to take off. What was interesting about it, we designed a system where when you confirmed what you were inspecting, which you could only do when you were exactly at that location, the shutter would snap and take a picture of whatever the device was. So the user wasn't squaring up on it like they were deliberately actively taking a photo. We called it passive image harvesting, right? It was basically that target would move on the X and Z axis so we could get different perspectives. So now you had data married with images, which would have created a really sophisticated data set, especially when you think of the thousands of people doing thousands of actions every day. So that was a big one, but it's also a sort of bittersweet thing for me because so it never really got off the ground before I left JLO. And funny enough, like one of the big lessons is the local developer that we worked with in Hong Kong kind of took their own version of it and then started shopping that around. And, you know, it's one of those things that like the original developer who I connected with and brought into JLL didn't necessarily have the resources to litigate, but that local developer here in Hong Kong that sort of took and ran with it has since won a prop tech award for this product. So there's something there, but it was just in the sort of stagnation of trying to integrate it into a huge organization like JLL that the two original parties weren't able to capitalize effectively.
I think that's a good lesson to learn about sort of like how you want to bring technology from what you mentioned about a startup technology into a 100,000 people kind of environment is a little bit different. Even when I was WOHUP, we took something a bit more simpler to try to deal with the QA inspections as well in the same kind of learning. And we have to try to be much more deliberate and slow because things like internet within the built environment is actually very tricky. I think a lot of people totally underestimate the difficulty of getting a proper broadband connection in a construction environment. But I want to sort of continue the conversation. I know you also set up something called the Urban Lab within JLL. Can you talk about some of the challenges that you face? I mean, building a prop tech accelerator And then also working with partners like, say, Swire Properties, which and Ping An, for example, in China.
Yeah, I should start with the best part. The idea for Urban Lab started with myself and a gentleman called Anthony Liu, who is currently the head of innovation for Goodman in Asia Pacific. And he was at Swire at the time. So that's where the JLL Swire partnership side came from. He and I were trying to figure out, like, look, we need to crack China. How can we do it effectively? And so, you know, basically spitballing over beers one night, we came up with what became the sort of proto version of that idea. And one of the things we understood, he had a much better experience in China than I did, but of course, my time in Wuhan and doing business across the border informed a lot of it. We knew that in China, no one would care about JLL and Swire partnership. Like, it's just like, yes, these are big brands, but these are big brands if you work in real estate. And we knew that we had to seek out partners that were going to, like, the mistake so many programs make is they think, slap our logo on it and people will come. But good founders are discerning. Like, simply dovetailing or even sidecarring to your company's brand, it doesn't do as much work as you might think it does at a big corporate. Like, your perception is very different from market perception, especially outside of your sector. Like, you know, one of the things I think property companies, developers in particular, make a mistake is they think Joe on the street really has a relationship to their brand. And to be honest with you, before I worked in real estate in Hong Kong, I couldn't tell you the names of two property developers. Now I know them all and I know many people there, but that's what we recognize. So we went and sought out potential partners who could do two things for us. Give us credibility in China, which one of the partners that came on board was Ping An. And for those who don't know, Ping An is one of the largest insurance companies in the world, certainly the largest in China. They do some incredible technology around just insurance, but also, you know, again, long before the AI craze, Peter, the founder of Ping An, we got together at the demo center. He was using AI to try and complete Beethoven's Last Symphony, like, as something he just wanted to personally fund. Like, he wanted to see it seen through. So they were really on the cutting edge of tech, as many Chinese companies are. That gave us credibility. We also were working with some other partners that I can't mention because they eventually dropped out. But we were very strategic and very deliberate in how we brought in the partners. And I think that that was the big success, is having a plan of action and layers of contingency, because it all the way up to the last minute, it was four partners and then one had to drop out. But because we had covered, you know, we had the China credibility and we had these two real estate powerhouses, we had something like 100 and some applicants to the first cohort. And so that was great.
Can you talk about the insights, like the success and learnings from Urban Lab, more from an accelerator working with startup companies? And how many companies have you worked with? What kind of projects that benefited from these four partnerships?
Look, I think the biggest learning that I had, and by extension, JLL, in my last capacity, was that it's not sufficient to take these companies and then just let them in the door. You can't hand one of your business lines the keys and expect them to drive. So one of the first cohort companies in Urban Lab was a robotics company, and we created a revenue sharing agreement with them. Any property that you get into through us, there's a revenue share. But the downstream incentives weren't sufficient enough. There wasn't enough. We didn't provide enough tools to the people who were actually interacting with the properties to then want to actually be able to do it. Most of them didn't even know about it. And that speaks to the size of an organization like that. But, you know, when you sit up in an organization, you sometimes forget you can't just speak something into existence, that you need a ground game. So JLL managed, when I was there, there was over 5,000 properties that they managed across Asia. This should have been a huge windfall for that company. And it wasn't, because we just kind of plugged it in. And then, you know, we tried to foster it. We did educational sessions and things like that. But unless you make it a very frictionless and incentivized experience, it's not going to take off. So I think that's a big lesson. That calls back to what I was saying earlier about startups infiltrating. It is not enough to get in the door of a large corporate. What the one piece of advice I will give every startup interacting with any corporate, not just JLL, is establish chill metrics and timelines for when you get out of these discussions, because huge corporates, by no malicious intent, can become a black hole. And that evokes this idea of like you get sucked in and you disappear, but it's actually worse than that for startups because you get orbited around and around for so long. And it's with the best intentions. I can say that because I wanted to see these startups succeed, but it's meeting after meeting after meeting, which is, it's a resource drain for the startup, obviously. Their time is their resource. Well, funny enough, the irony of it is it's also a resource drain for the corporates because it's a lot of overpaid people having meetings that could have been emails, right? And again, no hard decision-making. And I think on the other side of that, from the corporate side, you need to establish your own kill metrics. You need to establish your own path to outcomes. Like that's what often doesn't happen. So there's often no responsible party at the end of a discussion or around integration of these technologies. And so everyone wants to sign their name to the success, but no one wants to, you know, sign up to be the one that says, okay, I will put the implementation plan into place. I will secure the funding. All of that still has to happen inside the walls of an organization as well.
Mm. So you highlighted a misconception and what the advice that you would give to a startup in handling big companies. And I think it doesn't just work with just prop tech with JL, but it also work with a lot of other sectors. What criteria would you use to evaluate and invest in this kind of early stage prop tech companies?
Look, it's a sort of typical boilerplate. The first one is compatibility with the organization. That, you know, this is where when a lot of my job at JLL functionally for the ecosystem interaction was helping people understand that like we do or we don't do that, right? So a company I ended up investing in personally came to us with a construction technology solution. And we, you know, I had to explain to them, I was like, you might see us at construction projects, but we're the construction project managers. And we like this wouldn't, we're not a point of insertion for you. And so a lot of it's helping navigate the complexities of the fact that all big corporates aren't really a single entity. They're not a hive mind. They're a bunch of business lines that carry the same flag. That was my experience, not just at JLL, but many of the corporates that I advised during my management consultancy days. And that's where I would just say that, you know, when you're trying to work with a big corporate, you need to, going back to the evaluation framework, but you are looking at basically answering to how you fit in. So doing your homework to know, like, hey, this is the business line I think we can serve. And this goes back to a very important lesson that my friend Anthony, I mentioned earlier, really tries to impart on a lot of the startups in the ecosystem and that he works with is, know the outcomes, that way you know who the customer is. Like if you don't know the outcomes you're delivering, if it's just a sort of ambiguous, I want to work with JLL and slap their logo on my deck, doesn't work. But if you say these are the outcomes, someone in a position like mine can go, this is who you talk to. And if you don't get a definitive answer from them, just move on, right? Mm-hmm. The other thing that we really looked for beyond that was scalability, right? Everyone's looking for the upside. You know, what is the potential? Do they, you know, can this go beyond the borders of the example I used earlier? You know, transactions data is easy. It's not easy anywhere. It's not easy in Singapore, but it's much easier in Singapore than it is in Thailand or Vietnam. And so, you know, it's things like that. Does it have transferability? Yeah, and beyond that, it's just the general state of the organization. Do we like the founders, right? This is the typical question. Do we like the founders? Do we vibe with them? And, you know, are they running an effective business and not just a grand idea?
So maybe just to summarize the conversation, what are the current trends that are shaping prop tech industry in the Asia Pacific? Given now commercial real estate is in a little bit of a buying because of hybrid or remote work, you'll call it. Yeah.
You know, that's a generous way to put it. I think given the current state, I'll say it. I'm lucky to be an independent operator now where I can say it's bleak. Like the state of commercial real estate, even residential real estate is fairly bleak. It's especially bleak in Hong Kong and not just because we have a lot of storm weather right now. Look, it's rough. It's rough because of interest rates. It's rough because of oversupply. The trend shaping property technology, I want to start with the trend that's dying, which is really an important one. It's an extension of Silicon Valley culture writ large. Silicon Valley has suffered from what I like to call Silicon Valley's hammer, right? Basically, Maslow's hammer being, if the only tool you ever know is a hammer, everything is a nail. Silicon Valley's hammer is, the only tool you've ever known is SaaS, then everything's a dashboard. And so the first generation, the first wave of prop tech, in my experience, in my opinion, was dashboards for everything. So the answer was always, here's a dashboard. But the question that I always had to pose and that often could not be answered was, where does the data come from? So what's that shift represent? The shift is now back to more fundamentals. We're starting to see great technology products that are serving those lower, the underserviced like personas within the built environment, within the entire real estate lifecycle, people doing operations work that isn't sexy, and harvesting data from that and using that to float up and actually create. We don't need dashboards if you can ask a chatbot a question. But the reason you can't ask a chatbot a question is it's not even a chicken and egg issue. There's not enough data. And the other thing I would say is I hope that we'll see this trend take shape. And this, my friend Mark Cunningham, he's really been a proponent of this, is we need to see more data standards. I know that, you know, AI is allowing for better handling of unstructured data. But until the end user clients of these big property service organizations start asking for their, like start mandating in their contracts that the data captured by the service providers belongs to the client organization, there's not a lot of transferability across that. And there's unnecessary amounts of data protectionism because data is this amorphous, ephemeral thing out quite literally in the cloud, right? That like, oh, we got to take care of this because this is our moat. But in reality, it's not really a moat and it's not really being used effectively. So like what used to be considered, you know, effective data just isn't. And so the trend is to getting effective data. And I hope too that by extension, the trend is better data standards and sharing of that so that we can have, you know, just better experiences, whether you're on the service side or you're on the consumption side.
I'm going to switch gears now to talk about your current gig then. So you said that from prop tech to deploy is something that you brought some of your experience that you learned into it. Can you specifically talk about the problem which deploy is trying to solve?
Yeah. So we talked about my last role and in very quick summation, my last role was head of innovation. The fact of the matter was I was participating in the venture economy in that capacity. Typically the way that it looked like was, you know, JLL would exercise first rights of refusal. I mentioned before in one case, I actually invested personally as an angel investor. But in many cases, I would send those deals off to investors. And I might meet up with them a year or two later and like, oh, thanks. That was a great founder. Let me buy you beers tonight. Right. And it's like, well, you know, like the social contract would dictate I don't need to be rewarded for that. That's fine. That is there was no agreement in place or anything like that. So the problem I sought to solve was how can I participate and still enjoy the type of job or the job security of a great job like I had at JLL. But then it became more apparent to me that we also need to serve, there's an underserved class of great startups, right? There's a bit of survivor's guilt. So we mentioned founding an accelerator. I also managed Asia's first prop tech accelerator, which was a joint venture between Lendlease and JLL called Propel Asia. And post-COVID, only one startup survived. And there's a lot of survivor's guilt for that. And it had to do almost purely with funding. One pivoted and the other, like, but the rest, it was all funding. So you had this, that's a street level hit rate, right? One out of five, 20%. That's pretty good. But not when you have the backing of two giant organizations. And so there was a survivor's guilt of that. Startups need help getting funding. And then there was the realization that there are a lot of people who just don't know the access point for getting into the innovation economy, right? I couldn't be a venture partner in my last role because that was a conflict of interest. But then I thought there's got to be a way to get more participation from people who are big industry participants day to day. And that's what sort of started deploy and better deal flow and the due diligence process you front run with active industry experts. And so it started going back to my process engineering days, thinking about how the process could be reworked, and then got together with my co-founder, Sophia, who is the tech whiz, and we then built the technology layer that now enables a more participatory means of getting experts involved, front-running due diligence with expert pre-qualification, and then helping startups actively fundraise through that vehicle.
So one interesting conversation we had when we were having coffee together was a very, you didn't talk about that at the start of the conversation. Can you talk about your experience with Bridgewater Associates, which is a very well-known hedge fund, that led you to work out the mechanics on how deploy is being used and the incentives they provide for the different stakeholders within?
Yeah, for full context, I don't know how much I'm allowed to actually discuss, if I'm being honest. But when I was working for the Goodteam consultancy, I was sent to work for Bridgewater for 4 months to close out year-end project. I was just there as sort of a project hitman, get these off the street, right? And so anytime you engage in short-term engagement, you get to be a sort of active audience member. So I got to observe how they have a system of peer evaluation. And so the system, my understanding is it still doesn't exist. It still exists, but isn't mandatory the way that it was when I was there in 2014 and 15. But basically every meeting that finished, everyone had to evaluate the participants in that meeting on a few different factors. And then the aggregate of those different evaluations helped inform your credibility, your strengths, and then from that would encourage redistribution of teams to create stronger teams. It was not a perfect system. In many ways, it could be observed as being draconian, but there were a lot of interesting things that I observed from that. But at the same time, in that consulting company I was working for, we were using a system called Kudos, which was a way to essentially log and thank your peers. You say, oh, thanks for this, blah, blah, blah. What I realized in retrospect, like having this conversation with you now, was both get weaponized. Like both systems, one was more adversarial, that being the DOT system within Bridgewater, and the other one being more complementary, both get weaponized, right? Whether like the weaponization in an adversarial system is the active use of it, and the weaponization in a complementary system is the withholding of it, right? And so what I realized is really that's because it's your name that's attributed to it. And there's one other system we can sort of point to that has helped inform all of our reputation management and credibility systems that are now self-regulating within the deploy backend is LinkedIn endorsements. LinkedIn endorsements are a brilliant idea that doesn't work. So the brilliant idea is it allows for sort of, I guess, verified search indexing. Right, because now if I want to search for project management, I'm going to get the hits of the people who are, you know, have lots of endorsements for it. The problem was is LinkedIn never assigned any value or scarcity to them. And so the only reason that we get endorsements, I know every time I only get endorsements, so somebody you've never heard of has endorsed you for these four skills that you're not actually good at. And then 5 minutes later comes the cold pitch email, right? Like it's, again, weaponization. It's weaponizing flattery for, you know, a point of entry for, in my case, almost always outsourced IT services. But yeah, it's a combination of all of those systems. And what we did was we created anonymized and double blind layers, trying to pull the best aspects of all of those so that, you know, from Bridgewater and the DOT system, it's peer evaluation, but you don't know who you're evaluating. You're just evaluating the sort of work that's been done. From the Kudos system, it's basically looking at how do you sort of calibrate against, you know, what is over positivity or over negativity. You're still looking for outliers. That is early stage venture investing, but we want to make sure the outliers are outliers that are informed by real expertise and not just laziness or sort of a particular attitude or sensibility. And then for LinkedIn, being able to actually then index that and organize that information in a meaningful way, that's how all of that's informed. But the last thing I'll say respective to Bridgewater is it was an incredibly powerful system. It was a great system. But what I don't believe, having done change management and transformation work for large corporates all over Asia, is it's not something you can plug in, you can integrate into an existing organization. It only works when sort of starting from zero or in a very sort of hermetic organization like a hedge fund. And so, yeah, I hope that we can take the best parts and make them work to people's advantage.
I think a lot of the thing about the system by Bridgewater is now being laid out in a book called The Fund. So I think it's pretty much public how it works. Mm. I would say a more diplomatic way of saying is that, you know, what Ray Dalio is doing with that particular system is no different from a Chinese Tao Kei, or we call big boss manages, micromanages his entire team. It's exactly that kind of cultural. Maybe that's also the reason why he likes China so much. Well, maybe just to add a little bit more, what is the value proposition for funds to work with Deploy? And also tell me how you select your scouts and experts within the application itself.
Yeah, so the value proposition for funds to work with Deploy is unrivaled reach. Essentially, Deploy as a product for our clients is a scout network in a box. Most venture funds don't have scout networks because the upfront costs are prohibitive. I mean, we're talking millions of dollars and essentially what are sunk costs, right? Like, if you think of how a scout network breaks down, and I'm only laying this out for those in your audience who might not know, but essentially you're giving escrow accounts to a number of people who you think can reach potential deals that you don't have the people power to reach for currently. But those escrow accounts, essentially what they amount to, you know, it's not a fair comparison, but it's a bunch of roulette bets, right? People are placing bets for you with your money, and then hopefully one of them pays off. And yes, the power law kicks in here, and you're still, you know, the 3% of your wins are going to be the ones that cover 97% of your portfolio. But, you know, the value proposition we offer is through our tech-enabled work, you're able to have hundreds of scouts, if not thousands of scouts, you know. So if we use Southeast Asia as an example, you can have an office in Bangkok and still not be at all the events going on in a single night, even if you have 10 people in that office, because the traffic, the distribution of them. That's equally true in Saigon, in Jakarta, in, you know, Kuala Lumpur. Geographic coverage is so difficult here, but then just domain expertise and the ability to rapidly diversify is only becoming more important. And our system offers both of that through the network effect and then through our, all the things I just laid out without trying to give away too much of our special sauce, you know, the peer-to-peer evaluation models that all of our deals go through. That's the other part that in today's world, most of the time, experts are brought in at the end of the due diligence process. And the sunk cost fallacy typically will override the expert's opinion. I know that because I was the expert for so long. I still am. I'm still asked a lot of times to look at property technology deals for investors. And short of waving my hands and going, this is like Theranos type of fraud, they just go, well, we've got to deploy the capital, you know, which is why it's a great name. We've got to deploy the capital and, you know, we've already put all these resources into due diligence. So our thesis, which is starting to be proven, is that by front running with the expertise, people who are genuinely close to the problem, not casual observers or analysts who have had to learn it in short order, you're actually able to make smarter decisions. The other thing that I think we solve for funds is so much of their deal flow is often just an email. Hey, Bernard, check this out, PDF attached, which means you are like, even if you are have a cursory understanding of whatever problem they're trying to solve, you don't know the nuances enough, and it's really still a gut check. Venture investing, especially in a non-zero interest rate environment, has to be more than, you know, just intuition at this point. It has to be a little more sophisticated, and we've created the tools to do that.
Mm. So one more question before my traditional closing question. So how does the product work, and where is Deploy at the moment?
So Deploy is, we just broke 100 scouts. We're about 2 months into our public beta. We spent about a year building the foundational tech. The product works simply by our scouts. And you asked how our scouts are screened and monitored. The reason we spent a year building foundational tech is the system has to be self-regulating so we can start bringing on other participants. We started in property technology vertical, because myself and one of our advisors could be the backstop if bad deals were getting past our peer-to-peer evaluation system. We would know the machine was broken if it got through, if bad stuff got through. And we intentionally chucked bad stuff in to see what happened, right? You got to poison the well a little bit to figure out what's going on. So in terms of how we now do our scouts are only invited by other scouts. So you have to use an invite code. But what makes that interesting is we can also socially graft, although graft works as well, right? Because we're adding to our network. We can socially graft the points of origin and spheres of influences. It also means we can fence them off. So if some of our clients want to have a particular network or want to tap very narrow bits of expertise, they can actually have a, you know, sort of ring-fenced group, almost like an SPV, but without all the additional commitments. So the way that our app works from a supply side is people who are attending events in any discipline and might be meeting startups that they find interesting. Should they meet one that they find interesting, they simply pull out the app, have that startup scan a QR code, or they share it through, you know, through AirDrop or whatever. And that's that startup then signs up through a web portal. And that's now attributed to the scout that found it, the participant in our network that found it. After that, the scout's role becomes basically guide, right? They start by scouting and finding, and then they guide the startup to making sure that their pitch is kind of showtime ready. We're not quite to the YC level of sophistication for applying or anything like that, but the scout is there to say, hey, you're asking for $4 million free product is a bit ridiculous. The scout has to say, yes, I'm going to now sponsor you to go in. And sponsorship on our platform means using some of your ability to submit future deals. So there's a backend token management system that we won't get into the complexities of today, but you have a limited amount of deals you can put forward before we throttle that. And so a scout sponsors the deal. Once they've done that, and once the scout says, yes, I approve it, they assign it to two domains. So we're never looking at it through one lens. They assign it to two domains, which then distributes it out to a pool of evaluators who only look at the business. They don't evaluate the investment. They're only looking at it through the lens of feasibility and through their understanding of the problem. And those experts that are evaluating the deals are unable to see where the deal originated from. They don't know who the scout is that sent it in. And the scout is never able to evaluate their own deal. The reason being, we want to level the playing field. We want people who normally don't have a door into the innovation economy to start to build their portfolio. And so if an investment is made by that's originated from a scout, that scout gets a promissory note from the investor for 2.5% of the upside in that investment, the carried interest for, to use the industry parlance, right? And so now you can, we like to say this allows people to convert their domain expertise and social capital into real capital. And that's our approach.
So my traditional closing question, what does great look like for Deploy?
Great looks like successful deals being done, founders who didn't have opportunity getting it now, and new participants coming into the innovation economy. That's a great day for Deploy. So if you're interested, you can reach out.
Okay. Many thanks for coming on the show, Jordan. So in closing, two quick questions. Any recommendations that inspired you recently?
Yes, watch the Fallout show on Amazon. It's beautifully written. I'm a huge fan of the games. My wife knew nothing about the games and loved the show. It's a great watch.
Interesting. How do my audience find you?
I basically just use LinkedIn for business stuff, but deploycapital.online is our website, and you can email me at jordan@deploycapital.online as well.
And of course, you can find us on every podcast platform and also on YouTube, and subscribe to us even in Instagram and TikTok. So Jordan, many thanks for coming on the show, and I look forward to speak to you soon.
I hope to see you soon too, Bernard. Thank you.